Yes, he is.
Hey, Dan.
Morning.
Glad you could make it. Okay. Got it. All right. So, a couple of just the announcements. We have a doodle poll going out. I think Jill sent it out Monday or so. There it is. Trying to find time for our, what we're going to try to do over 2 days with 4 hours a day. And Jill, you got any idea yet on possibilities?
Take a look at this. And for the dates that are really popular, like it looks like 17 and above, if you're an unavailable, see if there's any way to change that to available and modify it by, let's say, tomorrow. And then we'll go with the ones that are most popular for people. And we generally tend to like to have them in the same week.
Okay, so let me.
Jill, did you send this out?
Yeah, everyone's got it.
Okay, so if you can go through and if it's possible to make it or change things around to, it looks like that November 22nd, 23rd looks pretty good. And then December 16th and 17th. So see what you can do about moving things around.
Jill, can you remind us times on those dates? Was it
sure. It's 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. Pacific each day. Those are the best across the whole time zone spectrum, especially with when we loop in London.
Thanks.
Okay. Sarah's not here for a publications update. Leah, you have anything on the data access committee update?
We don't have any new requests, but someone who requested data when she was finishing her degree in South Korea, she is now a postdoc at Harvard, and she emailed me and is going to update her request and specify it. So hopefully that will go through soon.
All right. So I know a lot of us were busy with grants and getting things in. And this we haven't had really an update on people's projects in quite some time, except for someone at the end of the meeting telling us what some new late data would be. And so I thought it would be at this time a reasonable prelude to this, our fall meeting, to get an update on where people projects are and what they figure they can finish up by the end of CFAS-4 and what work is in progress and where it's going. So we can just go, the administrative core is just continuing to do what it does. We got everybody's application in. I do have a request. I want to get your permission to share your proposals with the Science Advisory Board in preparation for the reverse site visit for CFAS-5. So if you've submitted an application for CFAS-5, I'd like you to give us permission either to send out the grant that we have, or if you want to keep certain things confidential, to let us know what pages we should delete before we post them up for the Science Advisory Board to see them. So, for example, personnel salaries and things like that, if you don't want that to be public, effort should be included, but the salary range doesn't have to be. And that way, the Science Advisory Board can start looking through these proposals to help us prepare for the upcoming potential site visit for CFAS-5. Jill can send out a reminder about that if need be. Other than that, I think we've just been trying to coordinate and keep everybody happy. We haven't had to purchase any new equipment, although if people do need items, we may have some funds toward the end of this year to purchase things if people need them for projects or primarily to help coordinate projects between different sites. All right, let's hear from Dr. Jones. Any questions about the admin core?
Ed, do you have any idea about when the reverse site visit might happen?
I'm thinking it's probably going to be, it's not going to be in person, probably. It's going to be a Zoom call or a WebEx, however they do it at NIH. And I'm assuming that it will probably be at the beginning of the year. It could be late, it could be in December, but I'm assuming that to put this together is going to take quite some time. I have not talked to Abe about it, but I know that in the past, because of all the conflicts of interest, to find people who are knowledgeable about FAS and don't have a conflict with somebody in this consortium. So I'm assuming it'll be January.
Okay.
Bill or Joe? Joe's on.
Ed, I think your guess is almost as if my guess.
Okay.
It's pretty close. Should be, all likelihood of the beginning of the year.
Yeah, so, there are a lot of projects, and I'm going to ask individuals to read closely other people's projects so that, we get a list of questions that I think are going to be obvious that the committee is going to ask, and that we prepare for that. I think most of us have been through one of these things. We know what they're like. They're not so great doing them via Zoom from our experience last time, but it's what we got to deal with. So we'll just have to deal with it.
I would add, we have much more experience doing these kind of meetings now, as everyone does. And I've seen a few firsthand, and they've gone pretty well for other consortia. So
yeah, the last time we couldn't see the questioner. So that was difficult. But I know we'll all miss going to Washington in January. So it's always a highlight of the year type of thing. So, all right, any other questions for the admin core? All right, so the dysmorphology. Ken, Miguel, if you could kind of give us an update of where you are in CFAS 4, what you've managed to do, and what you still have to do prior to the end of the granting year.
Right, Ed. So I'll start off and just talk about our first two of our aims, one of which is to provide provide support to all the CIFASD clinical projects in terms of diagnosis of fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. I really have nothing to report where we are. And I don't mean to say it sounds to say that we are at the mercy of the PIs, but obviously we depend upon them contacting us, and we've not been contacted to do any physical exams as far as this is concerned over the last period of time. As far as our research registry is concerned, I think that's going well. We are continuing to recruit patients from our Friday clinics to our research registry. I can't tell you the exact number at this point because I didn't check it recently, but it's going up steadily. And so we are continuing to get a number of individuals who have been prenatally exposed to alcohol into that registry. So that's two of our aims. And Miguel, are you on?
Yes.
Can you say a word about the Alaska issue?
Yes. So, yeah, I mean, in terms of telemedicine, I really have no news about Alaska right now. I know several people were trying Morpheus Q. Some people were collecting data. Sarah Evans was collecting, but I have had no further contact after the application, but we certainly should. And then what we are also doing is trying to use Morpheus Q in the clinic and generate pilot data, both for the initial application and now for maybe for the site visit. So we're also putting together an IRB proposal for that. But yeah, certainly we should persist in talking to the people in Alaska and see what the updates are.
Excuse me, in CFAS 4, I believe you had the telehealth training.
Exactly.
And assessments that you were going to be doing, I believe it was with Minnesota. And I'm assuming that Minnesota is seeing kids from what I've been able to garner. And I'm wondering if you've done anything at all along with those lines.
We have.
I mean, I think one of the things that come up in CFAS 5 review is going to be how effective this telehealth training is with and remote assessments.
We have not done any telehealth with Minnesota.
Jeff, is that still a possibility that could go on?
Ken, you and Miguel have made arrangements with someone through Proof Alliance. Am I remembering that incorrectly? I don't recall the details of what the training was going to be, but I thought that you were looking at some sites that involved outlying areas and reservations and whatnot.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were talking about doing telehealth at Jeff's place. Are you talking about that, Ed, or are you talking about something else?
Well, what was ever in the proposal, and I think it was to try to do the remote sites in Minnesota, but I was under the impression anyway that the kids in these remote sites might be seen also in Jeff's clinic, since I think you're the only one who does that diagnostic in the state right now. No?
Well, I can tell you that we have not set up anything with remote areas in Minnesota, and maybe we should be trying to do that.
It just strikes me as it's going to be an obvious question that comes up in a review.
Gotcha.
You have to remember the reviewers will see your previous proposal.
Right. So. Right. Well, we will. Jeff, is it all right if I give you a call and discuss this a little bit with you?
Sure.
Thanks.
Any other questions for Ken or Miguel? All right. We move on to Claire. Claire, are you there? You're muted.
I want to just share some slides, if I can. Just to give you an idea where things are. Okay. Is that working?
Not yet.
Okay. I'm trying to share the screen. Share.
There we go.
Okay. And I'm trying to update. Okay. I just want to let you know, this is the status of the data collection. And we're particularly doing well with tier two, but tier one is fine. And we're also collecting for COVID. In terms of what, and data analysis, what we've been doing is taking the data from the tier one questionnaire and doing a path analyses to look at the not only the effect of alcohol exposure on the outcome variables we've talked about before, but also to look at the contribution of the various other factors, which we are perfectly sure also related to outcomes. So here we're looking at symptoms of depression. And, you know, I'm not going to take a long time, any of these, I know there are many to get through, but basically what do we look at? When we look at our path analysis, we find that adults with the history of alcohol were likely to report symptoms of depression if they had adverse childhood experiences. We have essentially what's called an indirect path there. And you could look at the box down below that explains what the indirect path is about. But essentially it said there's a mediated effect of the alcohol exposure on depression. So as alcohol goes up, depression goes up as well. It is mediated. This is a mediated effect going through the ACEs in addition to any indirect effect. We also see that other stressful life experiences are having an impact as well. And these include having low SES or coming from a socially disadvantaged group or being female, who are themselves likely to be a socially disadvantaged group. So what we look at in this group is there is a relationship between prenatal exposure, but it is a complicated relationship, which is not surprising after 35 years, in which we see a number of other factors contributing to outcomes. We also are beginning to look at it in relation to other outcomes. Here we have diabetes, and we do find a relationship between, if you can see, alcohol exposure, the effect, physical effects of alcohol exposure, and then diabetes is related. The other thing that we are in the process right now is looking at National Death Index and working through the CDC's National Center for Health Statistics, which, by the way, is a whole deal getting permission to do. We are going to take about 900 people who are in the database and submit them to the National Death Index to determine whether or not we see a higher mortality rate and what are the causes of death for this group. The fact that there might be a higher mortality is suggested by data already collected in Seattle, in which of the 30 individuals who are reported to be deceased, 29 are in the alcohol group. And we are hoping that this will get done shortly. So that's what we are, in fact, doing at the present time. And more to follow.
Thanks, Claire. Any questions for Claire?
Yeah. I'd like to know, yes, is making a diagnosis or even a deferred diagnosis of an FASD part of this project?
Well, the problem is, how do you make a diagnosis at 40, basically? The individuals in Seattle have a diagnosis, and the ones in Atlanta could be diagnosed, so we can certainly do that.
You know, Larry Bird also has some data on mortality, and he also found a higher incidence of mortality in the siblings of individuals with FAS. So I don't know if that's of any use for you, but.
Well, that's interesting. I'm not sure we have data on the siblings though.
So.
And I've got a question. Yep.
Bill.
Claire. Yep.
Yes.
Claire, do you have any updates on the supplement related to COVID?
We have about 140 some cases of people who responded to the questionnaire. And of course the National Death Index is part of the COVID supplement. So we've been working on that. Last time I analyzed the COVID data, which was several months ago, there was a general anxiety about COVID and so on, but it didn't seem to be particularly specific to alcohol-affected individuals, to alcohol-exposed individuals. There was just, everybody was disturbed and upset about it. So, and it was affecting everybody's lives, but it wasn't wasn't specific at that point.
And do you have any insights in terms of whether it has a greater impact on mental health or substance use in the cohort?
They were not reporting that at this time. Again, everybody was feeling anxious and depressed and stressed by COVID, and the people who were alcohol exposed didn't express it any more than anybody else, which when you think about it, isn't really surprising. But as we get a larger sample, we make it a little bit more effect.
There.
Okay. Thanks.
Do you have people over there that will do the evaluation of the physical features, or is it something that you would want us to do?
Yeah, that's a whole issue, as you know, Miguel, because the person we had doing that took a job in Arizona and left. So we need to get back together with you and figure out another solution to that. I really wish we could do the Morpheus on the individuals we're seeing, because it would be more efficient, probably. But we have to retrain and find another physician.
I mean, I do think at this point, ideally, we should probably do both methods, right? So, but I mean, you know, also evaluating the standard way. But that's easily trainable. If there is,
we have no problems with you using Morpheus now either. So if you get an IRB,
that would be a great thing.
If you get an IRB approval, they could easily download it and do it.
Oh, that would be great. We have a variety of things. Seattle, the physician there is doing the dysmorphia. So that is not a dysmorphology. That's not a problem. In Atlanta, we've had an issue because the person took another job and went away. So we're trying to sort that out.
Leah, you had a question?
I didn't want to take up time, but I was just curious why you would expect them to have higher anxiety. I would have thought with the cognitive problems they have, they wouldn't understand the full impact and have lower anxiety. No.
Good question. What we've been finding and what people report to us in our questionnaire is that there's a very high anxiety is the chiefly reported mental health issue in this group, and it is highly related to alcohol exposure. So they are more anxious than others in general, and they are more anxious about COVID. They do understand COVID.
Yeah,
okay.
I'll just chime in for one sec. We have a relatively small COVID sample as well, but of course they understand it. It completely impacts their lives. They're locked down. They lose all their social opportunities and so on and so on. Maybe they don't understand the grander picture of COVID pandemic, but it certainly has impacted their lives dramatically, and they're less able to cope with it compared to unexposed individuals. Anyway. Sorry.
Someone like me who was built for a pandemic. All right. Let's move on. Mike, you gave a presentation last time. So let's hear what you have and see what, if there are any questions.
Yeah, sure thing. So we just had Ralph, who was our software engineer on the project, who we had initially on the project as from a supplement. We got him back onto the project to do some technical work. So stuff with our software and things like that are really moving forward at a really good pace at the moment. We've also got a new guy that we've been trying to recruit for about 12 months, but had recruitment issues galore here. Also starting, and he's another technical person. So yeah, full steam ahead with that side of things to try and push things along a bit more. So that's really, really good. In terms of that side of things, we've never been so strong. We just had a paper accepted and published on using transfer learning for automated point placement on landmark placements, and that was accepted in the Journal of it's an IEEE journal. So that's good. That was like last week, I think that was accepted. What else have we got going on? I'm working quite closely with another publication in the workings that's progressing really well is the one I've got going with Raja at the moment, looking at some of his data. Got about 120 alcohol exposed images that we're processing automatically through face screen, and to see what kind of outcomes we're getting. And the only thing we have to go on that data is the four-digit code and 2D assessments. So that very carefully worded paper is coming out, not as a almost like a comparison to the 2D tool, but not a criticism. I don't know how to. It will be phrased very carefully, but
it will get criticized. Trust me. So
I know, yeah, for sure. Yeah, it will be worded carefully, but it's yeah. So I've got another. I was down at Rogers Clinic a few weeks ago and gathering things up, and we are now pacing forward with that, and hopefully going to have it written up in the next few months or so, submitted.
What do you think the bottom line in the conclusion section will say?
I don't know. I think it will say we can do this just like the 2D tools can, but we can also do a whole bunch of other stuff that makes it more beneficial. So without belittling what clinicians are already using, and because there's not much out there, and we are just saying, you know, we can achieve this level of accuracy in comparison and a whole bunch more stuff that might be useful. I think that's probably the best way of doing it.
I like the whole bunch of other stuff that might be useful. I like that sentence. That's perfect. Yeah.
Verbatim.
Is it really, but what is it, Mike?
What is what?
The other bunch of stuff.
Well, the ability to pick out the minor anomalies that are associated with FSD. So the prevalence and occurrence of midfacial hyperplasia and micrognathia are the two things that we'll be adding to it. So you know that cohort is spread out across the spectrum in the kind of proportions you'd expect, and so we're seeing all the minor anomalies and things like that which you can't pick up with the other tools. So it's identifying both the cardinal features as well as the minor anomalies is basically what I'm going to say. Whereas the 2D photographic tool focuses on cardinal features. And that's then the four-digit
computer metrics. Mike, have you figured out face screen, what exactly the risk score is going to look like? What, you know, what is that number? What's that the clinicians are going to use to give them some kind of probability that you've got an alcohol exposed individual?
I think that the actual risk score after a lot of thought can only really be calculated once you've got the neurobehavior element to it as well. You can say, I guess the risk score based on the dysmorphism alone, I guess it's only worth as much as the physical feature identification. So there'll be a two-pronged attempt on that one. Yes. But that will be something that takes into account what we can detect in every part of the face and kind of combines it in a way that can produce that kind of outcome.
Any other questions? Okay. Leon, any update on any of the genetic work ongoing?
We, because of the change in personnel last spring, we had some people that we owed money to that had completed some portions. So we just finished that. And now we're going to start sending out invitations to do the brain online and the health questions that we put together with Claire and Joanne. So that's exciting in that we'll be able, because all of their exposed participants also provide saliva. So we'll be able to expand that data set of people who have health information and genetics.
Thanks. Questions?
Leah, I see you've been posting on Facebook about DIG and some of the work of the FAS, of CFAS on the lake. Has that been allowing you to attract any participants, anybody interested in friends?
Yeah, so one of the things we also did was we started the social media campaign. We started tweeting and posting more things on Facebook, and I've been trying to share those posts. And apparently it's slowly but steadily increasing our followers and our viewers on both Tweet and Facebook.
Good job. Okay, Joanne, on immune function?
Yes, let me just share. I just have two slides. Okay, 1 second, just let me. Okay, so we have two aims. The first aim is really on maternal and child immune biomarkers as predictors of outcomes. So we are still working on the mother-child manuscript on the Ukraine cohort. But we've now had some meetings with Tina and Rajesh to say, how can we get the most out of the data we have, since we, our group and Rajesh's group have aliquots from the same people to some extent. So our goal now is to try to expand what we can do together to look at two biomarkers. If you have combined biomarkers, does that give you higher predictive value? What is the contribution of each? Immune biomarkers and microRNAs. So we're looking to do this on the two sets of data we have, blood samples on children from the FASD registry research subject pool that Ken was just talking about. Those samples are ready to be shipped and we'll each get an aliquot from those subjects that we can work with. And then we have overlapping samples on mother and child pairs from the Ukraine cohort. And our goal is to try to expand that a bit so that I would get some additional samples from subjects that Rajesh already has that he's run and vice versa, so that our total overlap can expand. And then we can begin to look at in two different subject groups, two different cohort groups, to see what we can do in terms of looking at both biomarkers together. So that's our aim one. And then the second aim was to increase, to extend to adulthood, and that's our adult health study we're running in parallel with Claire. So just a reminder that we have just the tier two, we have just subjects that we've brought in. And to date, we have 72 participants. We have not been able to bring people back. We're working on that at this point. It looked like everything was open and we had geared up to start recruiting for the fall, and then things shut down again because of the Delta variant. So we're up in a very limited way right now. The clinics can bring people, but as a research project, we're still limited in what we can do face-to-face. But in relation to the dysmorphology we've just been talking about, so one of the goals of the adult project is that we are collecting dysmorphology, and we've been able to do that in Vancouver, partly through telemedicine. So that is one point toward that we can look at as a big success. Three of my group went to San Diego to train with Ken and Miguel and Tammy, Charlize, and Parker. And so we were able to do some of the dysmorphology here with telemedicine connection to Ken while he watched us do it. And then some we were able to then continue doing alone. So we have dysmorphology data on all of the adults we've collected so far, and that's been uploaded to the repository in Indiana. And maybe that would be one way to start to begin to look at diagnosis in adults. Of course, the dysmorphology exam uses the same criteria as is used for diagnosis in kids, because that's what we have. But just to look at what the facial features look like, we do have 2D pictures also that we've uploaded for Mike Suddy, but I think that he said it's not been hugely productive, but anyway, that is a second resource. So maybe we should talk about that, whether those data could be mined a little bit to begin to look at dysmorphology in adulthood. And then the other thing is we're working with a colleague in Guelph in Ontario to try to expand our recruitment of adults. They may be more open than we to bring people in, and Caitlin runs a clinic. So we're hoping to maybe continue some of our recruitment there and be able to fill in our try to reach our target or as close to it as we can. So we're working with her and starting to put in the ethics to be able to collect data there. So that's it.
Okay, thank you. Any questions?
Quick question. Was Deepak Sarkar's sample overlapping the one that you have and that Rajesh has? Because, you know, he was looking at POMC and PER2 and finding relationships also. And there's a nice connection between what he did and its potential effect on the hypothalamic pituitary axis and stress, and, you know, the work that you're doing. So I wonder if there's an opportunity to have three data sets here rather than two.
I don't know. So Tina, maybe you can.
Yeah, there is some overlap. So for the maternal samples that he used, there definitely is some overlap. And so we could certainly look and see where the three intersect.
Or we can even possibly, if three don't intersect, maybe two of the three intersect. So let's see what we can do with that. That would be another way to mine the data we currently have, which would be great.
Yeah, good.
Okay, anything else? All right.
Ed, just a quick follow-up for Tina. I should probably know this, but in the Ukrainian cohort, did we take any measures of alcohol metabolite biomarkers?
The only thing we did was look at PEF in blood spots from newly recruited mothers, and that's been done by USDTL.
So is there any overlap with those samples and the ones that Joanne had just mentioned where you look at, you know, the other two biomarkers and
see a
sample that's been looked at with three different biomarkers?
Yeah, so because this required collecting whole blood, we only did those on the mothers recruited in, you know, in the earlier part of phase four. So those maternal samples, though, were captured, and Joanne has not gotten those yet, or Rajesh, but they could be done. There could be complete overlap between those three for moms.
Okay.
Oh, that would be great.
Okay, Christy?
Sure, I'll go ahead and do both of our studies. So for the FMF Connect caregiver app, I just resubmitted our manuscript for our beta test trial and was able to respond to all the reviews. So hopefully that will get accepted soon. Our feasibility trial was completed, got our last few participants beginning of the summer. The data is now all transcribed from interviews, and we're going to start working on coding in the next couple of weeks. My graduate student, who's working on developing a teacher companion, she completed interviews in the spring and is now have all those transcripts transcribed and is working on coding to try to inform a website for teachers. We're very close to being able to launch our randomized controlled trial. Just kind of working through some final IRB and logistical issues. I've identified the folks who are going to provide coaching in our coaching arm of the trial, and I'm going to be working on training them up in the next couple of weeks. We also created a newsletter for our FMF Connect and kind of more broadly to try to engage a broader recruitment network. And just keep people apprised of what we're working on and have a Twitter handle there. Our first newsletter went out. We'll have another one here in the next few weeks and then monthly from there. We also are working on developing a whole list of emails for all the clinics and support agencies in the U.S. from some work. I can't remember her last name, but Barbara, I think, Ed, you know her well. Had been working on. So that's been helpful. And then I've been doing on Twitter an FASD Strong campaign each day. And our university is going to be putting out a press release about a new paper that we have coming out about strengths related to some my K Award data set. And so I'm hoping it'll also be mentioning the app and CFAS within that. So I'm hoping that will also garner some attention right around the time that we're about to do the RCT. For the adult app, our advisory board and research team are going to be co-presenting at the Proof Alliance conference in October. That's going to include a demonstration of our design prototype, as well as a panel discussion with our advisory board and feedback from the audience. We have focus groups that we are planning. We were originally going to do those at the Vancouver International Conference, but the last couple of years we've been because of the cancellation with COVID. But we are going to be doing that virtually. We figured out the logistics. I am also working on the IRB for that. I'm guessing it'll be probably tail end of October, beginning of November when we'll do that. But our team is getting up and ready, and our partners on the advisory board are going to be leading the focus groups discussions. And I think they'll do a really nice job. We have our research team that will support each of those. So I think that's exciting to see that. Broader CFAS, we continue to do Morpheus Q in clinic. We have a growing number of providers doing that as kids are coming back into clinic. We also finally got the IRB worked out between Indiana University and Rochester to be able to bring in my participants from another clinical trial that I've been running who, unfortunately, because of COVID, we couldn't do it in person with their visits, but we're going to invite them all to come back in, and as many as we can collect data in person for the DIG protocol, as well as our family group. So my team is going to be meeting with the DIG folks, I think in an hour from now, to get final updated training on that. So busy time here in Rochester.
Thanks. Any questions? Okay, next on the list I have Scott and Johan.
I'll go first. I have just a quick idea. Everybody knows we've been working with this.
Hard to hear.
Sorry?
It was a little hard to hear.
Is that better?
Not good.
No, huh. How about now?
That's better.
I'll try to get close. So everybody knows we've been working with these 6J mice that have like a 50% incidence of craniofacial effects versus the 6N mice, which are like 20%. And then last year we found another strain of mice that had an incidence of craniofacial malformations at about 80%, which was kind of exciting. And then in the last couple of months, we've actually found a strain that is very closely related to the strain we found last year, but it's at this point seems to be completely impervious.
Stay close to the mic, Scott.
Okay. Again, we have found a strain of mice that seems to be completely impervious to the craniofacial effects of alcohol. That's all.
That's it. All right. Johan?
Yeah, I have a few slides. I'll go through it really quick. So, are you seeing that?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
All right. So, so we just published this characterization of P53. It's in Press and Acer. And so another gene, so from the 6Js, this gene here was implicated in ethanol teratogenesis. We have generated the mutant. I think I've shown you the phenotype. But right now we have RNA-seq data that we're waiting on. So that'll be really awesome to compare to Scott's RNA-seq data. The stages of the embryos should be similar enough that we can do that. We're planning to submit some single cell RNA sequencing on these fish as well. This is another gene that came out of, not from the mouse, but from the forward genetic screen that we were really excited about. It's a member of this LRP family, but had never been characterized functionally before. And so what these things do is act as co-receptors for other signaling pathways. And you've heard about Sonic a lot. so they're ethanol sensitive. And it looks like in Tim's characterization that it's regulating the signaling of FGF, actually another signaling pathway. So these are untreated mutants of that LRP, FGF3. You make a double mutant and it just looks like a combination of these two untreated mutants. The interesting bit comes when you add alcohol So that's the LRP mutant. FGF mutants don't appear sensitized to alcohol at all. They just look like an untreated mutant. But you make the double, and now they have these like really, really profound craniofacial defects. So in the presence of alcohol, we think that this gene is functioning to regulate FGF signaling. But in the absence of alcohol, this FGF requirement or the ethanol interaction isn't occurring. That didn't come out as well as I meant it to. But lastly, some other cool stuff. I think I'd already mentioned that I had been voted to go to full professor. That is now official as of the beginning of this month. Other exciting news, my postdoc just started as an assistant professor up in South Dakota in the Department of Biology. And that's it for me.
Well, congratulations on the promotion and a good football team, you know, so everything's good there in Texas. And I'm glad Johan got a job. I was tired of writing letters, so.
If I could add one more thing about Johan. Johan will be presenting this Friday at our FASD Alliance. We're in a lot of excitement talking about fish genetics to parents and caregivers.
All right, Jeff. We got about three more to go through. So we got about 10, 12 minutes.
All right. I'm sharing my screen. Hopefully you can see that by now.
Yep.
Okay. So if you look at the far right column, you can see that we have exceeded our goals on all of our intentions. And that includes the our first set of MRI scans, our cognitive evaluations, including Sarah's additional battery, and also now time two scans. So we're over 100% on what we thought we were going to be able to do to bring people back. So despite COVID, we've been still bringing people in and masking and scanning, and that's gone successfully. So we're basically at a stopping point now in terms of data collection for time two. And if you remember, this is roughly 15 months. It's now looking more like probably 18 months on average when we brought people back between these two time points. A little bit delayed because of COVID. So that data is now in full process. I'll just update you on this. This was one of the analyses I was kind of excited about, looking at cortical myelin in this population. And we had this negative finding. Essentially, we didn't find a difference in cortical myelin between alcohol exposed and controls. And we've now tried to publish this twice, first in NeuroImage Clinical, and then again in ACER, and it's been rejected both times. So I haven't had a lot of experience trying to publish negative findings. And so far, I'm not real pleased with trying to publish negative findings. We're going to continue to work on this, flesh it out, do a little bit of reanalysis, and hopefully get this published, because I think it's important that, you know, we publish this real data and this real finding that maybe not everything is atypical in the brain in FASD, just like we wouldn't expect it to be. We're doing longitudinal analyses now that we finished our time two set of data collection, and there are some automated pipelines for this. We're using the FSL pipelines, and this is just to show you an example of what it looks like when we combine a set of brains from time one and a set of brains from time two. We're able to look at a lot of things, but one of the more interesting things is this symmetrized percent change. So really taking each voxel or each region of the brain and looking at comparisons between time one and time two. As these children age, what's the trajectory of the development in that particular region of the brain? And then we can parse that. How does that differ between alcohol and controls? How does that change relate to cognitive functioning? How does that relate to their diagnostic status? So that's in progress. And then coming up this in just about 2 weeks now, October 1st, my research lab moves to a brand new facility. This is the Masonic Institute for the Developing Brain. All of child psychiatry, a lot of the Institute of Child Development, any research having to do with child or adolescent brain development including autism and storage diseases and all kinds of neurologic conditions, are moving into a brand new facility, including our clinics. So we're now going to be in one new facility, clinic space on the first floor, research space on the second floor, research magnet to, for scanning. Should be a pretty exciting opportunity, but I'll be out of commission pretty much all of October, transitioning between these two facilities. So we're going to try to run participants late October, but should be pretty exciting once we're up and running. Hope to be able to show some of you that the next time RSA is in town. Stop.
Thanks, Jeff. Any questions for Jeff? And then let's hear from Tina and Raj.
Okay, so just to close out the Tories project, we communicated with them last week and they got the 39 samples of whole blood sent same day from the FASD registry biorepository. So they're considering that complete. We were not able to recruit an exposed comparison children. So they said that they will do that there and then complete the project on their end. You heard from Joanne that we've got together, Rajesh, myself and Joanne, a week or so ago and talked about what we have left in terms of child blood samples. So from the research registry, there's about 31 samples from children with a known diagnostic classification. And then there's about 50 that we've received from Ukraine that, you know, have been sitting here for over a year. So we're pooling those. There's enough aliquots for both Joanne and Rajesh to get one of them.
Miguel, mute.
So we're hoping we can finish that by the end of the year to sort of address our aim that was supposed to be looking at mother-infant pairs because we haven't been able to get the infant blood spots. And then thanks to Leah's help, we finished fixing the glitch and being able to do data entry for the school age testing. So they're entering those battery test results now. So Claire and Julie will be working on the analysis of the school age battery up test for those 96 kids. And then last, we had a supplement that's been dragging on for the Gabriella Miller XO opportunity. And they, the last communication I had with them was a couple of weeks ago. And they said they're of the 480 samples they got, they are had to go into the blood spots for the kids and do a deeper dive to try to get enough DNA, but they're pretty close to finishing that. So we had reserved time and expertise to do the analysis if we get those sequence data this year. Hopefully we're going to get it in the next couple of weeks. And then that piece also is going to feed into one of the questions that Susan Smith had. That's it. Anything else, Rajesh?
Raj?
I just add that I think we're pretty close to completing the child study. So just the children itself, I think that's within the next couple, within the next month or so, it will be finished and ready to write up. And then on the animal side, with the microRNAs that Tina and I found in the Ukraine mums that were elevated in mid-pregnancy, we're doing a follow-up analysis with using some RNA-seq studies that was being written up right now. So that, again, I really feel like with these microRNAs, it's also important to have a parallel track of showing that these are functional, not just kind of happenstance molecules.
Okay, we got the two UH2 projects here, Sue and Annika, Susan Smith and Annika. If you could just give us a brief, Sue, you want to go first?
Sure. I actually did have slides, but I'll just read them to you.
You could put them up. It's all right.
Okay.
Just a couple minutes.
All right. There we go. Okay. Come on. There we go. Okay, so we've been doing a little waiting on the data. In April, we received the phenotypic data for CFAS3. in June, we received access to the genetic data set in CFAS3. We've been reviewing all the phenotypes within those data sets and prioritized the morphological data for our first pass analysis. We have focused then on that data set and identifying the covariates and that shouldn't be co-founders, confounders for the association model. And then we've also been extracting the relevant genotypes from this cohort with a focus on the five SNPs within our choline transporter gene, SLC44A1. We're now in the midst of data cleansing for the dysmorphology data, parsing the raw data, removing irrelevant data, imputing missing information, the comments, and that sort of thing, getting it into shape where we can actually then have clean data sets that we can start running on the analysis. So then our next steps on this, we're planning to then, in the next couple of weeks, we cross fingers, run the initial associations on those five initial SNPs in the gene. And this is very much an iterative process to determine what will be in a report, look at the outliers and how to address those. And then we repeat looking at effect sizes and significance to generate insight into the power within that data set and how much skewedness there is, and then repeated iterations to then finally identify what our power is going to be, adding additional imputations as needed. Current status is that we all have genetic matches with phenotypes only for CFAS3, but if that pipeline and then the power look good, we'll proceed to look at dysmorphology with the CFAS2. And then from those data sets, we'll then advance to the more complex behavioral data analysis within those two cohorts. And thank you, Tina, for the update. We're looking forward to those data too.
And then Annika, I know you got to talk later on today, so I'll give you a little preview. If everyone could just stay on just a few more minutes, I'd appreciate it.
So we don't have a particular update right now. We're still, in terms of the CFAS studies, we're working, putting all the documentation in place for the two universities to play nicely together. And we anticipate that that will be in place shortly. So we'll be contacting Sarah and Jeff to get going.
Okay. All right, are there any other questions or general information? Bill, Joe, anything from NIAAA?
Well, the only thing I'd say is thank everyone for the update. And, you know, it's not too early to encourage folks to get papers out as we go closer and closer to the reverse site visit. So I'll just throw it out there. I'm sure it's on everyone's minds in terms of publications. But I do want to thank the folks that responded to the RFI for the ICC-FASD strategic plan. So that was much appreciated. So thank you.
Joe, any comments?
Yeah, I don't have any comment. I just thank you for the update and great job, everyone.
Tom, I'm sorry, I skipped over you. Anything from NOFAS? I know that you've been legislatively doing a lot, and any quick comments to CFAS? Well,
I guess also FASD Awareness Month. We did a chat yesterday, Twitter chat with NIAAA, CDC, ACOG, some other folks. And Bill, I think you're going to join our annual virtual affiliate summit next week to talk about NIAAA, FASD, and the CFAS briefly. I hope you know that. If not, I'll follow up.
I don't, so we should follow up.
I talked with some of the folks over there, and they said they were putting it in front of you. So yes, I will follow up. You know, as we do the push for the legislation, we've continued to steadily capture more and more advocates, mostly families. So certainly interested in the promotion of any recruitment efforts that you're all doing. Please, if you just maybe have a notice or a link that Andy Ketcher can feature in our social media and the roundup, that'd be great. If you want to talk about something a little bit more comprehensive, you know, let me know. I was certainly, Leah, as we did a couple of years ago, very interested in a scene with these additional folks, if we might be able to engage with new people. Certainly willing to reach out to them. The bill, just quickly, unrelated to the CFAS and all of that, Senator Susan Collins, Senator Brian Schatz from Hawaii, they joined the bill on that side. Three new House members this week. Still, numbers not where we'd like to see, but absolutely everything that's happening in Washington, if there is, we're trying to stick provisions, the whole bill, whether it's the reconciliation bill, obviously the fiscal year 22 appropriations spending. We'll see. Hopefully we won't have a government shutdown. If we do, it means both sides think they'll benefit from it, which never works out that way, but we're still at that. And we've had today now over 125 meetings, including with some of you joining as experts congressional staff to brief them on the importance of this issue and the latest findings. And quick note from Kathy, she's now had 65 presentations in which she mentioned CFAS and your research as part of grand rounds that she's doing with the ACOG and AAP FASD champions. So that's it.
Okay, thanks. The SAB, any final comments?
Nope, nothing from me.
Nothing, Sarah Jo?
Nope, nothing from me.
Dan?
Okay.
James?
No, I'm good.
All good. Well, thank you, everyone, for being here. I think it was very informative. And I'll just reiterate what Bill said, is that for the reverse site visit, for people moving on in CFAS 5, you know, they will have your previous grant. They'll know what you said you were going to do. So try to address those issues. If you can get papers out, all the more better. I mean, we can still get things, at least at the reverse site visit, tell them when that question comes up. Well, what did you do about this? You can always then throw up a paper for Adam. So I will reiterate Bill's statement to see what you can do about papers and getting them out, and look forward to next month's call. So everybody have a good one, and take care. Bye.
Bye.